Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our state government reporter brings us up to date on a big finish in the state legislature. He looks at the bills that'll either pass now or get passed up.
First, we're wrapping up our three-day heroin series with a discussion on how communities around Wisconsin are dealing with the problem of heroin addiction. State crime labs are processing a growing number of heroin cases. That number has steadily increased in almost every Wisconsin county over the last 3 years. And the number of heroin-related deaths is on the rise, going up 50% in the last year and quadrupling since 2007.
Yesterday, we talked to Republican State Representative John Nygren about some of his statewide legislation to help combat the problem of heroin abuse. Today, we're focusing on La Crosse County.
We have three guests with us. First off, we have from the La Crosse County Heroin Task Force, Keith Lease, Executive Director for the Cooley Council on Addictions, and Al Bliss, Health Educator for the La Crosse County Health Department. And also joining us, Emily Ladone, who is a recovering addict working with the task force. They're joining us from our studios in La Crosse. Keith, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Al, good to have you along.
Thank you.
And Emily, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Al, I want to start with you. What does the heroin problem in La Crosse County look like?
Sure. I would say if we go back just to 2010, that the heroin deaths, overdoses that you would hear about were almost next to zero. Now, if you look at the numbers that we have today, in combination with alcohol and other drugs, that's about 19 to 20 deaths per year. Now, that's up significantly if you look back to even 10 or so years ago, but most recently since 2010. That's just one picture, I think, of the problem. There certainly are a lot of overdoses that do occur within our community. I know that Tri-State Ambulance, for example, has had on an average of 200 distributions of Narcan, or the drug to reverse the overdose effects. Mm-hmm. So 200 average per year.
Per year. Keith, we hear the word epidemic a lot in association with mm-hmm. the heroin problem in Wisconsin and in other places. Is that a fair word to use?
You know, I think it is. It might not be overall numbers a huge number, but if you just look at how much it's rising, my background is in counseling, and I would do groups inside of the La Crosse County Jail. And when I first started, there was a mixture of people dealing with a lot of different substance abuse issues. And by the time that I finished over there a little over a year ago, practically everyone that was a part of those groups was dealing with an opiate addiction at some stage. So, you know, even within our jails and without, it's a significant rise in a really short period of time.
Keith, can you give us a sense of just what the impact has been on the La Crosse area, on the community, law enforcement, health officials as well? What's the impact on La Crosse?
Well, it really crosses a lot of different boundaries and borders, and it affects the community as a whole, which is why, you know, and Al will talk a little bit about this, why we're using a public health model to deal with it. It's not just the homeless population. It's not just the populations inside of the jails. It really does affect everyone in the community in some way, shape, or form. And we're really trying to get that information out there so that we can really take an approach that's community-wide in trying to solve this problem.
And we'll definitely be talking about the health implications and the way you're approaching it as a public health problem, but I want to get Emily in on this first. Emily, could you tell us about how you first started being involved with the La Crosse Community Task Force?
Well, I've been clean and sober for almost 3 years now, and my most recent drug of choice was heroin. And so Keith saw me as somebody that would be beneficial to the group with, you know, a very recent experience with it.
And is your job to work with the community members and say, look, I got clean and you can too?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a job necessarily, but I do share my experience with those situations, anything that I can bring to the table.
What kind of response do you get from people when you're out there talking about what you went through?
I get a lot of people that either can't believe that I've come from that kind of place because they only know me as how I am today. I also get a lot of questions. A lot of people are either misinformed or just don't know things about heroin addiction or the things that I've been through, the struggles that I've had.
What kind of misinformation is out there that you want to set straight?
Well, generally speaking, that drug addicts or heroin users are bad people. The fact is that they have a disease. They're sick. And maybe not enough people know that there are ways to get help. And that's kind of one of the aspects that we're coming from, is helping the addicts themselves.
Alice, is a good point to turn to you now. Emily saying that heroin addicts have a disease and they're sick, and this is the public health approach that you're taking at La Crosse Community Task Force. What kind of approaches can you take from that angle to help people?
Right. From a public health standpoint, we're working with a model. It's called the public health model. It was actually a disease model back in the 30s, developed then. And with epidemiology and different diseases. And so out of this model, it involves a triad. Basically, we have the agent or the vehicle itself. In this case, the agent would be the drug, would be heroin. So we have examples would be heroin is inexpensive. It's not – we don't know the purity of it. And also the availability. This is dealing with, we have to look at strategies that we can deal with directly with the agent. The other one that's becoming more popular is the environment. How can we look at improving the environment with policies, programs, or practices? So, for example, this could be the environment. We have a drug court or justice sanctions program. People can go and get help and often get a lesser charge, but they're also getting treatment and causing less crime. That's what we're hoping for. So that's a good example of environmental strategies. The idea is to get a balance of these three and what our community needs. So we have to use this model by doing, you know, a pretty comprehensive needs assessment. The last component of the public health model is the population or the host. So this would be like the user themselves, or it could be also the counselors on the other side of it from the treatment. It could be dealing with families or the other individuals that can help the person in recovery.
How much can be done, do you think, at the local level, Keith, to put a dent in the heroin problem?
I think we can make a difference. I think it's unrealistic to believe that will completely eradicate the possibility of overdose or the use of a chemical completely. But I think we can make a significant impact. And you know, we have to do that by bringing together the silos of treatment, of prevention, of enforcement, you know, working together as a community, as a whole, to really make that impact. Otherwise, if we don't work together, we all do our own things, the chances of us actually making a difference, you know, we'll be putting a Band-Aid on a significant wound instead of treating it and taking care of it for the long haul.
Keith, do you think that people in Wisconsin and in your community are aware of the extent of the heroin problem? It seems sometimes that it's greeted with surprise when you see, for example, a New York Times article about heroin hitting Vermont or Wisconsin, mm-hmm. for that matter. Do people know?
Mm-hmm. We're getting better at it. And thanks to programs like this, thanks to local news agencies, thanks to people like Representative Nygren who are going out there and sharing their experiences and letting people know this isn't just an urban problem. This is a rural issue. This crosses all types of boundaries. It affects every single community out there. And unfortunately, I think people are becoming aware of this the hard way because some things are happening in their own communities and it's touching, you know, a lot of lives. So I think we're getting better at getting that word out, but I think we have a long way to go.
Emily, do you think that when someone has a heroin problem or a family member has a loved one with a heroin problem, do they know where to turn? Do they know what to do to get help yet?
Not always. I think that it has improved, and we're definitely working towards getting that information out there in any way that we can, even to, like, students in high schools. I know when I was in treatment, they did their best to share information with families of the addict in the treatment facility. I think that there's definitely a lot of hope in that area.
We're talking right now with Keith Lease and Al Bliss, both with La Crosse Community Task Force. Also joining us, Emily Ladone, who is a recovered addict working with that task force, talking about how the La Crosse community is dealing with the growing problem of heroin use.
We'll take your calls next. What do you think the community response for heroin addiction should be? What's going on in your community to try to tackle this problem? How has heroin abuse affected your community? Call in and share your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
We're picking up our discussion right now on how communities can and should respond to the growing problem of heroin addiction in Wisconsin. We have three guests with us. We have Keith Lease and Al Bliss, both with the La Crosse County Heroin Task Force, and Emily Ladone, a recovering addict working with that task force.
And you can join in, too. What do you think the community response for heroin addiction should be? What's going on in your community? Are you involved in some kind of effort like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
Now let's go to the phone lines right now. We've got Karen joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a son that's a heroin addict. He's been in had an addiction for like a year already. He's on Badger Care, and he desperately needs help. You can go to Rogers Memorial for like a 3-day detox thing, and then they ship you out of there. Where can you go for long-term help when you don't have insurance?
Okay, thank you, Karen, and good luck. The best to your son and to you. Keith, what do you think? We'll start with you, and maybe Al can chime in if that works too.
Right. Well, it's going to be different depending on the local community. Obviously, in Milwaukee, there are significant amount more resources available as opposed to some of the smaller communities. Trying to find opiate clinics here in La Crosse, we have AMS that takes cash for medical, like methadone and Suboxone. And so it's going to depend really on the different communities, but that's one of the biggest challenges is we have a lot of things that we know work. Now it's trying to find the funding to have them supported. A lot of times if somebody doesn't have insurance, they may need inpatient, but they can't get more than the 3-day stay that the caller ran into with her son. So it's a significant challenge that we're facing.
So if you don't have insurance and you go to one of these cash clinics that you were just talking about, typically what would you be paying out of pocket in cash for a longer term stay at a clinic like that?
I'm not 100% sure. I believe it's over $100 for a week for the medication that they receive there, but I don't have the specific numbers. We don't do any of the medical treatment at our clinic. For us, paying out of cash for behavioral treatment, some cognitive behavioral or things like that, would run you about $55 a session.
Okay, well, thank you again, Karen. And I want to ask you, Al, from what we've heard this week, a lot of people who develop an addiction to heroin seem to start with an addiction to painkillers that are prescribed. What can communities do to intervene before people make that next step and turn to heroin?
Right. There certainly are some important strategies, I think, that all communities can participate in. And one would be to have the take-back or drop-off days for prescription drugs. That's, like you mentioned, where many individuals have started. And once they've used that, they turn to heroin and other illicit substances. We are also working on permanent medication drop boxes in our communities, and we've had some really good success recently. We are going to have two set up here in La Crosse in the summer. By June, that's our goal. And we're working with three other communities. I think what's important is that people remember that these medications need to be not shared. They need to be disposed certainly after they've expired. And in many cases, it's where young people, individuals will get these medications from.
And let's go next to the phones. We have Matt joining us from Madison. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Yeah, I enjoy your program. I appreciate you guys having this topic.
Thank you.
I have a pretty close experience. I'm actually a recovering addict, and I've been through the drug court program, here in Dane County. And actually, that's actually been really helpful. They really care about people. You know, they're less punitive and more about, you know, trying to figure out what works. And, you know, so that's been really good for me, and I know it's been good for some other people that I know. There's definitely a long waiting list to get into that program, but once you're in, it's definitely beneficial. And I can definitely attest to the painkillers being, you know, sort of the gateway drug to heroin, because that was my experience. I actually knew a lot of people that would get painkillers from their parents to sell, and so that's definitely an issue. I think there has to be some form of accountability. I know this person was even reported multiple times and still managed to get a pretty substantial prescription every month.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your thoughts and your sharing your experience with us too, Matt. And he mentioned a program that worked pretty well for him. Al, are you familiar with that?
Well, one of the other programs I wanted to mention is to look at the Affordable Care Act and what's out there for treatment and counseling. I mean, that's something that we are trying to work with, is to expand the treatment window and to get individuals signed up for that. And there's, you know, various different levels of what that would cost. You can go on to the marketplace and go into plug in some information and see what that cost would be. Like the other gentleman said, the drug treatment courts is another way. Our county has services, mental health recovery services, that people can get triaged. They actually enter the Aging Disability Resource Center, and then they get triaged to mental health recovery. And there's certainly counselors and help available there, too. So that's another route that individuals can take, is check with their county services, too.
Now, I know that, Keith, the Heroin Task Force won't finalize any recommendations until later this month, but what kinds of solutions have you been looking at? You mentioned the drop boxes. What else is out there?
Yeah, so we've made some really good headway on drop boxes. Also, we want to raise the amount of the ability for our first responders to carry Narcan. So La Crosse is a part of a pilot program that allows firefighters to administer Narcan, which is the drug that can snap somebody out of a heroin overdose. What we would like to see is for all of our first responders, EMTs of all levels, to be able to administer that. Another big issue is the prescription monitoring program. I think it's been kind of touched on here lately with that connection between prescription medications and heroin. You know, a big area of need is to work with our providers to limit the amount of overprescribing, to limit the ability for people to doc shop, so to speak, to go to different hospitals. So that's something. Right now, Wisconsin does have a program. It's working at about 8% of providers are currently logged on to that, the last I heard. So we would like to get that up. We're doing a lot of work with prevention. We want to be able to prevent this or stop it before it happens. So getting in, starting in kindergarten, obviously not talking about heroin with kindergartners, but starting the refusal skills, starting the work with peer pressure, things like that, and really be able to use the prevention side of it. And then the other big one that we, La Crosse County, has already adopted is we have a local MEG unit, which is a collaborative effort between the local law enforcement agencies, and it gives them the ability to communicate with one another. If somebody is selling drugs, whether it's in La Crosse or Onalaska, West Salem, Holman, some of the other smaller communities outside of La Crosse, to be able to talk across those lines to increase the effectiveness of our enforcement. Those are just some of the general ones that we have on our list so far.
And Emily, I want to bring you in before we run out of time here. Is there anything that you would like to say to heroin addicts out there? And you've come out the other side. You've been clean and sober 3 years. What message of hope would you give people?
I guess one thing that I always struggled with is I didn't feel good enough, you know, and heroin was just like the end of a long journey of, you know, starting with drug use as a real young person, you know, with like marijuana and drinking. It started because I didn't feel good enough. You know, it was easier to just go get high than to try. I didn't feel like I could succeed at anything. I didn't have a lot of faith in myself and my abilities. So, you know, if anything, I encourage people to, you know, believe that they are worth it. And there's a much better life outside of, you know, the drug lifestyle, and that miracles can happen. And any recovering drug addict is definitely, you know, a walking, talking miracle. And that there is hope.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. And Keith and Al, thank you both for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us, Veronica. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Keith, Al, and Emily right now. Keith Lease, Executive Director for the Cooley Council on Addictions. Al Bliss, Health Educator there. And they both work with Emily Ladone, a recovering addict, also working with that task force.
You can find all of the Central Time Heroin series and WPR's coverage of Wisconsin's opiate problem at WPR.org/heroin.
Up next, we'll catch up with the state legislature. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about the writer behind the famous play A Raisin in the Sun. She's the latest in our Wisconsin Legends series.
It is the first day of spring today. People of Wisconsin rejoice because today, at least by the calendar, winter is over. So have a cheese curd, a beer, whatever makes you feel good, because this year we've earned it.
Yeah, it's not quite as warm as it looked out there when I went out for lunch. It was still pretty chilly, so I'm not going to rush out and celebrate, and neither is the State Assembly. They're in a marathon session today, hoping to wrap up business on a number of bills before the end of this year's legislative session.
WPR State Government reporter Sean Johnson joins us now. He's at the Capitol with the latest on what's happening. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So one of the bills that's getting a lot of attention this time around is the chemotherapy bill. Could you catch us up on that?
Yeah, some developments on that one today. This is a bill that I'm not sure many people were following until a couple weeks ago, when the Senate Republican leader, Scott Fitzgerald, used highly unusual parliamentary trick to keep it from getting a vote there. That kind of got people's attention, and suddenly the bill was on the calendar of the Senate this week, passed 30-2. There was some question about what the Assembly might do. If they amended it, there was a chance that, you know, that could effectively kill the bill if the Senate didn't go along. They have decided they are going to amend it, but it looks like this is an amendment that has advocates for cancer treatment on board. And what it would do is basically cap co-payments for oral chemotherapy. That's, you know, chemotherapy that you take with a pill at home. It would cap co-payments to that at $100 per month. And so, you know, again, cancer advocates were there saying that, you know, this is still a big victory for us. $100 is fair. It's kind of the upper limit of what they wanted to look at as far as copay goes, but they're in the support of the bill.
Now, advocates there are saying that a lot of the latest treatment in terms of chemotherapy are coming in the form of pills, of oral treatment chemotherapy, and that legislation needed to reflect that, and that some of the money needed to be used to help pay for those drugs.
Exactly. And really, it's been insurance companies who fought this, and, you know, because they believe it's going to be expensive. But we'll have to see. I actually haven't seen where, you know, they're going to end up on this amendment. You know, there was some talk that their opposition would be relaxed if you had this copayment. I haven't seen that yet. But, you know, it does look like something that is probably going to pass the Assembly later today or in the wee hours of the morning. You know, not sure, but this is something where we might have, you know, a big bipartisan vote potentially.
Now, another matter before the Assembly, this one's been controversial. This pertains to early voting. What's going on there?
Yeah, this would cap early voting, or, you know, in-person absentee voting at the city clerk's office to 45 hours a week in the 2 weeks preceding an election. It would also ban weekend early in-person absentee voting at the clerk's office. This is something that the Assembly already approved last year. The Senate took it up, added an amendment that would require the state to pick up half the costs of municipalities who, pay people extra for early voting. The Assembly says it's going to go along with those changes, and so that's going to be a bill that's headed to the governor's desk. That's one that where the governor has very consistently not taken a position. You know, he's even when he was asked in front of a friendly Republican crowd last night that you would assume was largely in support of the bill, the governor took a pass on saying where he stood on it, and he's been pretty consistent on that. But you can imagine, given the strong Republican votes it's received so far in the legislature, it's probably something he would support. Democrats don't like this because they say it's basically targeted at Madison and Milwaukee, cities that turn out a lot of Democratic voters and that use early voting extensively.
Now, Republicans, as you said, have been the ones driving this one. What have they been saying about why it's necessary?
They say it's about uniformity and that it will make sure that smaller municipalities, municipalities that don't have the resources that a Madison or a Milwaukee have and can't do this early voting to the degree that Madison or Milwaukee have, that they're not put at a disadvantage. The counter to that is that, in those smaller municipalities, those longer hours aren't necessarily needed because they don't have the issues that the big cities do with lines on election day.
And there's another one out there related to elections, a bill that already passed in the Senate, and it would give lobbyists more time during election years to make financial contributions to lawmakers and other candidates. What's going on here? Why is this popping up now?
Yeah, this is something that advocates have said is a good idea this year because Wisconsin is moving up its primary schedule. It used to have a primary in September that's getting moved up to August. This bill would move up when a lobbyist can write a direct check to a lawmaker from June to April. The counter to that argument from groups that advocate for campaign finance reform is basically that we need this like we need, another few months of winter. There's no reason to, nobody's clamoring for more lobbyists writing checks to lawmakers earlier in the year. And that this is, something that only a legislator could support.
Now, moving away from elections to another hot-button area, schools have been very much in the public eye in the legislature this past session, and school accountability is one that is still out there waiting to be decided. What's the Assembly considering today in regards to that?
This is something where Republicans are really at odds. I mean, this is definitely an internal Republican dispute on how to go forward on this, and it really boils down to whether they're going to take a bill that passed the Senate with pretty broad bipartisan support that would essentially move up the date of when new school report cards cover all schools, voucher schools, and public schools. The Assembly could take that up, and they would have passed something, and it would go to the governor's desk, and they would have kind of moved this issue forward incrementally. What they're considering, though, is amending that to include punishments for schools that don't meet state standards consistently, including even closing schools, public schools or private voucher schools that don't meet the standards. That has their caucus extremely divided. There are some members who say, look, if we're going to have school accountability that means anything, there has to be sanctions. There have to be punishments. But there are other members who say, if we do this, we're going to get killed for it, and rightly so.
So that one sounds like a toss-up right now. It sounds like anyone's guess.
Yeah, it's one of those where you actually don't know. The script has not yet been written on this one. Normally, when a calendar gets set for the legislature, it's pretty much you pretty much know how things are going to play out. On this particular issue, you don't know if Republicans are going to basically take the simpler bill and call it a year, or if they're going to try to pass this more aggressive bill and maybe go home having passed nothing.
Well, these are just a handful of the bills that are still being wrangled over tonight. It's supposed to be an all-nighter. I assume you've got your pajamas and your toothbrush and everything, and you're going to be settling in. But tell us, if a bill doesn't get moved forward tonight, what happens? How many do you think are going to be left on the table?
If a bill doesn't pass tonight, its chances of becoming law this year, go down several fold. This is sort of a self-imposed deadline. The legislature could be in under the calendar they set at the beginning of this two-year session. They could be in through the first week of April for regular business. The Assembly wants to get things wrapped up, though. The Senate's going to come back in the week of April 1st, and so the Assembly could do the same. So it's not like this is absolutely 100% the last session day, but this is a biggie, and that's why you see the calendar so loaded up with these controversial issues.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot, and good luck getting through the late night tonight.
All right, caffeine is the term.
Caffeine. All right. Well, that was WPR State Government Reporter Sean Johnson getting us caught up on the State Assembly's marathon session taking place right now.
Today's Wisconsin legend is playwright Lorraine Hansberry. She was the first black woman to write a play performed on Broadway. Her best-known work, the play A Raisin in the Sun, centers on the lives of African-Americans living under racial segregation in Chicago.
But before Hansberry became known on Broadway, she was a student at UW-Madison and already devoted to the cause of equal rights for minorities. Here to fill us in on the life and work of Lorraine Hansberry is Sandra Adell, professor of literature in the Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Sandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with how Hansberry ended up at UW-Madison. When was she here?
She was here in around 1948. And how she ended up here, that's quite a puzzle. I do not know. we don't have any records of any letters that she wrote to friends and family about her choice. I do know that everyone else in her family went to traditionally black colleges. Her parents were from, her mother's from Tennessee, her father was from Mississippi. They were a well-off family by any standards in the 1930s and 1940s. She was born in Chicago. But why she chose Madison, I'm hoping we will find out on April 1st when the Schomburg Center for African and African-American Culture opens up an online archive that have letters that have never been seen before and photographs that have never been published about her.
Yeah. What would have been like for her coming to the UW in that time, in the late 40s?
I can't imagine it, to tell you the truth, especially when you consider the few number of students of color we have here today, what, maybe less than 2,000. She would have been even, there would have been even fewer at the time. Now, I do know that she integrated an all-white woman's dorm while she was here. And she was also a member of what's called the Young Progressives. At one point during her sophomore year, she was the president of that organization. How big it was, I don't know. And I'm hoping, again, that we will find some of that out in the letters that she might have written home to her mother.
So she was already politically active. She said she desegregated a dorm, which is a pretty big thing to do when you're a college student. I wonder also if you know anything about the seeds of her literary career. Were any of those sown while she was here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me back up, though. Her activism and her literary career, those seeds were sown in Chicago. Her family, as I said, were quite well off. Her mother was a school teacher. Her father was a very successful real estate broker. And that family hosted some of the country's most outstanding black intellectuals, including Paul Robeson, who you might have known came here several times in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and also W.E.B. Du Bois, Langston Hughes, among others. So all of those seeds were sown in Chicago, in her home. Her father filed suit, Carl Hansberry, filed suit against the restrictive covenants that kept black people out of white communities in Chicago, and won. And that is what made what's called restrictive covenants illegal. And if you don't know what those mean, it is where a group of people will get together, white folks will get together, and sign agreements that become legal and binding that they will not rent or sell to blacks and Jews. And we even had restrictive covenants here in Madison, Wisconsin for many, many years until somebody looked at the laws and said, okay, we're getting rid of these. So this activism then came about as a result of her family environment. That's what she brought to Madison, Wisconsin with her, all of this upbringing in Chicago.
So there was never a question maybe in her mind that she would not continue that activism. She was going to do that right from the start, it
always
sounds like.
Always, yeah.
So where did the literary strand come from? You talked about her being brought up in an activist household. This was something that was part of her makeup. But what about the playwright part of her?
Well, that came as a result of her. When she came to Madison, she thought she was going to go into art education. And then she switched to creative writing. And when she saw O'Casey's Juno and the Peacock, that's the turning point for her. She saw it in a theater production here. And that's when she decided she wanted to go into playwriting. But even that, the experience of writing, we have to attribute that, to Paul Robeson and the black intellectuals that she met when she left here after her sophomore year and went to New York City.
So Paul Robeson and Lorraine Hansberry, both people who united entertainment, I guess, or popular culture and political activism. They didn't see a distinction between the two,
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Interesting.
Do you know whether she encountered any kind of opposition here or whether it was a town that was in a university that was ripe for progressive ideas?
No. Actually, if you look back at the history of blacks in Madison in the early part of the first half of the 20th century, and even today to some extent, it was very hostile environment. So you had to be strong and committed to change. Now, one of the other things I want to point out, though, is Lorraine Hansberry was a lesbian. And around 1950, by 1957, she had joined a group called the Daughters of Bilitis, which was in New York City, and started writing for a lesbian feminist paper. Now, think about this. We're talking about prior to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. But again, all of this development, she was ripe when it comes to, if you want to use those terms, when she went to New York, because she associated and became immediately involved with the New York intellectual group. She studied and took courses at the New School for Social Research, which was just a repository of intellectual and public intellectual work, not celebrity. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between that. I mean, these people weren't trying to be celebrities. They were trying to be public intellectuals. That their work had to be in the interest of better improving the conditions of all people.
So here in Madison, I don't know how much we know about the story of desegregating that dorm that she led. Was there an instant backlash to that? Did people pick up the idea and agree despite maybe being a hostile environment for a woman of color?
I have no idea. Don't know.
Yeah.
Now, what I do know is that I would like to back up to Chicago because I think there's a part of her history in Chicago that people are not aware of. And that is when in 1938, when her family, she was 8 years old at the time, moved into an all-white neighborhood, they encountered tremendous violence to the point that they were court ordered to leave, to move. And that's why her father filed the Hansberry versus Lee lawsuit to protest this restricted covenants. Mm. Okay, and so, that's a grand example. To what extent, and I don't know if she led, an effort to desegregate. I just think she went in there and said, I'm staying here, period. Mm. So, I don't know how much of a movement or who was behind her here in Madison when she went into that dorm.
Maybe she just refused to be segregated.
Yeah, which is what her parents refused. Mm-hmm. When they said, okay, you want to kick us out of this community? And it was very violent. The whites were very violent against it. We're going to take it all the way to the Supreme Court. So that's the kind of fight that she was exposed to all the time in her home and then when she went to New York.
Well, she sounds like an incredibly strong, dynamic person. I had no idea she was at the UW-Madison. What is your sense of her just as a person?
I wish I had known her.
Yeah.
I tell you, I'm very excited. I'm just looking forward to when the archive becomes live on April 1st.
Will you be there?
It's online.
It's online.
It's online. But I do want to point out a couple of other things, and that is she completed The Raisin in the Sun in 1957. It opened on Broadway at the Barrymore Theater in 1959 and ran for 530 performances. Now, there was a couple of important revivals. One was in 2003 with Sean Combs, P. Diddy, as Walter Lee Younger, Felicia Rashad as Lena Younger, and Audra McDonald as Ruth. This is an all-star cast. It's opening again. It's in previews right now at the Barrymore Theater, which is where it opened in 1959, with Denzel Washington as Walter Lee Younger. So this play lives on and on and on. Now, I don't know how much credit we can take for that play, except that she saw something here in Madison. She saw theater here, and that inspired her.
The play, do people watch it now as an artifact of another time, or does it really have a strong resonance with us today?
It resonates with us today because, it's dealing with a family who has suffered the loss of the patriarch, the husband. The father, rather. And it's a family dynamics. The story is about a family dynamics, but they're also moving into a white neighborhood. They're jammed up in this what's called a kitchenette apartment. And life is, they're stifled because there's no space for them to thrive. And so the mother and Mama Younger and Walter Lee are, they're butting heads here. So you've got all of these generational conflicts, but you also have the beginning of her feminism. She's way ahead of her time in creating a character, Benita, who in 1959 wants to be a doctor, not a nurse. Mm-hmm. And then there's a character named Asage, who's African, Nigerian. And this is the first time we see on stage an intelligent Nigerian or African, somebody from the African continent, who is not, our Tarzan stereotype. Mm-hmm. So she was
so
way
much
ahead
there,
of her time.
So much there. It sounds fascinating. Thank you so much for coming
Thank
on
you.
And sharing her life with us. We've been talking to Sandra Adele from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about Wisconsin legend Lorraine Hansberry.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, an inside look at the people who go to work for Wall Street banks and how the Great Recession changed their world.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.